Gregor's unique. He's a graduate of Cornell University School of Agriculture and the Tufts University School of Medicine, of Public Health and Animal Agriculture at the Humane Society of the United States, an internationally recognized lecturer. He's presented at the Conference of World Affairs, National Institute of Health, and the International Bird Flu Summit, testified before Congress as expert witness on in defense of Oprah Winfrey and the infamous meat defamation trial. His recent scientific publications include American Journal of Veterinary Medicine, Biosecurity and Bioterrorism, etc. His latest book is the acclaimed Bird Flu, A Virus for Our Own Hatching, is now available in full text at no cost at www.birdflu.org. Welcome back,
Michael. Thank you so much.
Good morning.
Morning.
According to the Director General of the According to the Director General of the World Health Organization, the three greatest threats facing humanity are the global food crisis, climate change, and pandemic influenza. Now, last year's flu pandemic killed tens of thousands of people, but in a world in which millions of people continue to die of diseases like AIDS, tuberculosis, malaria, why is there so much concern about that so-called swine flu? Because apparently the last time a nearly entirely new flu virus jumped species and caused a pandemic, it went on to become the deadliest plague in human history, the influenza pandemic of 1918, which killed more people in 25 weeks than AIDS has killed in 25 years. No war, no plague, no famine has ever killed so many people in so short a time. Where did it come from? Conventional wisdom is that the 1918 pandemic was triggered when H1N1 bird virus, in its entirety, all eight gene segments, jumped into human beings. We then apparently passed it along to pigs, sickening millions of them as well. After the pandemic, once our immune systems got used to the new virus, it turned into regular seasonal flu, and in pigs, it turned into what we now call classical swine flu. Before 1918, there aren't any reports of pigs ever getting the flu at all. So, throughout the roaring 20s, people got regular flu and pigs got swine flu. Same with the 30s and same with the 40s. Now, in the interest of time, I will skip over the discussion of 1957 and 1968 pandemics, but swine flu was stable throughout the 1950s and the 60s. And the 1970s in North America, Europe's a little different, but they don't have time to talk about it, and stable throughout the 1980s. But by 1999, everything changed. A never-before-described triple species flu virus arose. The classical swine flu virus, after being stable for 80 years straight, picked up three gene segments from the circulating human flu virus and two gene segments from a bird flu virus to create the first triple animal reassortment virus ever recorded. Now, our first discovered hybrid, a human-pig viral mutant, was discovered in an industrial pig operation in New Grove, North Carolina in August of 1998, owned by a big pork conglomerate named Hogslab. Within months of this discovery, our triple hybrid mutant had spread throughout the United States. Soon it spread into Canada. And by 2003, the majority of animals tested in industrial pig operations in Mexico also showed evidence of exposure to our triple hybrid strain. We then exported it to Asia, and then the favor apparently has been returned. After reshuffling with classic swine flu, our made in the USA triple reassortment virus picked up two gene segments from a Eurasian swine flu line to create the flu pandemic of 2009. Now, the primary progenitor, the main ancestor of the 2009 pandemic flu virus, as shown in orange, which I just replaced in white, was that triple hybrid strain that emerged and spread throughout these industrial pig facilities in the United States more than a decade ago. All right, so six out of the eight gene segments, three quarters of the pandemic virus, straight from our triple hybrid. In this diagram, these data are taken from the most comprehensive genetic analysis to date. Now, influenza experts have been warning about this triple hybrid virus for years. They call it an extremely promiscuous mammalian adapted virus. And, you know, flu scientists used to only worry about Southeast Asia, but given the experience of our triple hybrid mutant now, we need to look in our own backyard for where the next pandemic may appear, and 6 years later, it indeed did. So after 8 decades of stability, what happened in the 1990s that led to these unprecedented changes in swine influenza? And the same question with bird flu. No human deaths from avian influenza for eight decades until 1997, when H5N1 started killing people in Hong Kong, with a case fatality rate that continues to exceed 50%. Then H7N7 emerged in the Netherlands, went on to infect about 1,000 people with confirmed human-to-human transmission. Just two examples of the new bird flu viruses infecting people. Now, in poultry, the number of outbreaks of highly pathogenic avian influenza in the first few years of the century exceeds the total number of outbreaks for the entire last century, and so as one leading flu expert told Science, you know, we've gone from a few snowflakes to an avalanche. What's been happening in recent years to trigger this kind of, you know, evolution and fast forward for both swine and chicken flu viruses? Well, one can ask the world's leading expert, Dr. Robert Webster, as did the senior correspondent with NewsHour, with Jim Lair. Was there something qualitatively different about this last decade made it possible for this disease to do something it's never done before, some kind of changing conditions that suddenly lit a match to the tinder? Webster replied. He says, farming practices have changed. He talks about growing up on a farm. He says, now, we put millions of chickens into a chicken factory next door to a pig factory, and this virus is the opportunity to get one of these chicken factories, make billions and billions of mutations continuously. So what we've changed is the way we raise animals and our interaction with those animals, and he talks about how the virus can then escape these kind of facilities and infect wild birds. But, you know, what we've changed, I'd like to emphasize, is the way we raise animals. So 5 years ago now, the three kind of leading authorities got together for a joint consultation, the World Health Organization, Food and Agriculture Organization, the United Nations, and our world's leading veterinary authority, the World Organization for Animal Health. Their job was to uncover the key underlying causes of this kind of these emerging animal to human zoonotic diseases. Number one on their themes of risk factors was this increasing demand for animal protein the world over. Animals were domesticated 10,000 years ago, but really never before like this. Especially pigs and poultry. You know, chickens used to peck around the barnyard. But now chickens raising, I mean, are typically warehouse and sheds containing, you know, tens of thousands of birds. Half of egg-laying hens in the world are now intensively confined in what are called battery cages. These small barren wire enclosures are sending down long rows and often windowless sheds, coming up to 1 million birds on a single farm. And about half the world's pig population is currently now crowded in these industrial confinement operations, again, not just here, but now increasingly around the world. So, you know, this kind of old McDonald's farm got replaced by the new McDonald's farm, one might say. So these intensive systems represent perhaps the most profound alteration of the human-animal relationship in, you know, 10,000 years. According to the world's leading agriculture authority, the Food and Agriculture Organization, the UN, this acceleration of human influenza problems in recent years, kind of like snowflakes to an avalanche of people, too, right, is expected to largely relate to the intensification of poultry production, as well as possibly pig production as well. And so I'm actually going to, in the interest of time, actually skip over this rather amusing slide of what the poultry industry has to say about the problem. And go to what are the reasons, 10 reasons why industrial pork production may represent such a breeding ground for disease. And unfortunately today I just have time to touch on one. But the operation in Newton Grove, North Carolina, where a first type of swine flu virus arose, was a breeding facility whereas thousands of sows were confined in gestation crates, also known as sow stalls. These are kind of veal crate-like metal cages, about 2 feet wide. So, you know, these highly intelligent social animals basically were kept in a box week after week, month after month, nearly their entire lives. And they can develop, you know, crippling joint deformities and lameness and a number of other problems. And they did this to a dog and get thrown in jail in some states. Not only can these pregnant pigs not turn around, but they, in many circumstances, can barely really move at all. What does this mean from an animal health standpoint? Well, the rise in hormones, stress hormone levels in crated sows is thought to be because the interference with the expression of these natural maternal behaviors like nest building, and this frustration of normal maternal behavior may impair immunity. In fact, we have data showing that measures simple as providing straw bedding may decrease morbidity and mortality compared to these concrete slatted floors, presumably by eliminating the immunosuppressive stress of, you know, lying on bare concrete for full lives. Which can lead to increased infection risk. So this minimal act, right, providing straw, has been shown to decrease the risk of a swine influenza infection. And for those of you who's a German, maybe rusty, table 2 risk factors significantly associated with influenza virus infection compared to a straw bedding, these concrete slats were significantly associated with infection risk. Yet we often deny them even this modicum to their detriment, and potentially to ours as well. Again, I'm going to, because I want to get us back on track in terms of time, skip over some things that the Livestock and Meat Board has said in terms of defending these practices. I think it speaks, the fact that the industry needs to paint these pictures, really misleading pictures, shows how far animal agriculture has gone, really from the mainstream American values of just basic decency towards animals, and they know it, and I think that's important to know, right? So as a professor emeritus of animal science wrote, actually right here in Colorado, in one of his college textbooks, one of the best things modern animal agriculture has going for it is that most people haven't a clue how animals are raised. And for modern animal agribusiness, the less the consumer knows, the better. So, the greatest concern going forward, as I conclude, is that in a country like Indonesia, right, where we have an endemic situation with H5N1 in the poultry population, that a pig could get co-infected with H5N1 and H1N1 and theoretically produce a virus with the human transmissibility of H1N1, but the human lethality now about 60% of H5N1. What can we do to prevent this kind of thing in the future, these emergence of these viruses, these changes we're seeing? Well, the United Nations urges that governments, local authorities, and national agencies need to take a greatly increased role in combating the role of these so-called factory farms, which combine these live bird markets to provide ideal conditions for virus to spread and mutate into a more dangerous form. So-called factory farms we thought of as incubators for the original emergence of a dangerous strain to the flu. More than 5 years ago, APHA issued a moratorium, calling for a moratorium on factory farming, certainly a good step. In 2007, the Journal of the APA had an excellent editorial, which I've actually uploaded as a PDF, so I won't have to go through it, but basically arguing that not just for a de-intensification of the pork and poultry industries, but really raising the concern whether we want to decrease our the number of animals we're raising in terms of the risk of these new viruses emerging. Let me just leave you with, I'll skip this too. This entire presentation, which goes on for over an hour, I actually have on DVD, which I have to provide to everyone. Please grab a copy at the end, because I do want to get us on track in terms of being able to answer questions for the whole panel. So everything you see here in the entire presentation is on DVD. If there aren't enough for anyone, I'd be happy to send anyone copies. Let me end with a quote from the World Health Organization. The bottom line
bottom line is that humans have to think about how they raise their animals, how they farm them, how they market them. Basically, their whole relationship to the animal kingdom and the human kingdom is coming under stress. But in this age of emerging diseases, where we now have billions of curly-tailed and feathered test tubes for virus to incubate and mutate, with billions more spins at pandemic roulette, along with human culpability, though, comes hope. Right? If changes in human behavior can cause new diseases, well then, certainly changes in human behavior may prevent them in the future. Thank you. And this presentation is a very simplified version, obviously, for the underlying science, the evolutionary biological theory that underpins this. I've uploaded this PDF as well, an invited review, and if you'd like a hard copy or another copy, please email me and grab a DVD. Thank you.
So all speakers come up front, please, and we can have questions for Dr. Brager or any speakers. So questions. Yes.
Yeah, I was wondering, in the UK, they seem to have made quite a little improvement of pig production. I wondered to what extent that would be acceptable elsewhere. Because are you meant for the human lives of people really making sure that pigs are actually great animals?
Actually, Britain led the European Union, which is now in the process of phasing out all gestation crates, phasing out all battery cages, phasing out all veal crates across all 28 or so countries of the European Union. And we're seeing the same starting here in this country. So far we've had six states now that has passed referendums or through legislative measures have banned some of these practices. And so with the kind of momentum that appears to be building in this country, we would expect to see similar reforms in animal agribusiness in this country in the coming years. I certainly hope so. So, for example, in California, we had a lot of public health support with a Prop 2 passage, which eliminated all three of those practices. In Ohio, it was more difficult this last year, but it did not go to the ballot after all this last week, because an agreement was reached between the public health community, the animal welfare community, and the producers to phase out some of these practices, just on a slower timeline.
Other questions? Yes, ma'am.
If the shift in agriculture moved towards animal confinement 50 years ago, why now?
So it wasn't really 50 years ago. So if you look at, for example, the industrialization of the pork industry in North Carolina, for example, this is a relatively recent phenomenon. It's really the 90s when you saw this dramatic increase. And actually, on the I show some of the statistics where literally, going from within a matter of years from literally 2 million animals, which they've had for the last 50 years, to 10 million animals. In fact, that year that we hit 10 million, the emergence of that first triple, and it just this exponential growth. And with that, and that part of that is the number of smaller producers going down, and so these kind of larger operations with many more pigs has arisen. And so it's actually a recent phenomenon. Actually in Europe it's a little earlier, and that may in fact correlate with what they saw starting actually in the 70s in terms of these new, never before described reassortments of these swine and the avian viruses.
Other questions? Yeah, Tom.
There was some talk that the reason that a lot of that work in Carolina took place was because of contamination of the water table from waste, and they wanted to concentrate to the lower side of Froggies because of the real estate boom that was taking place, and they wanted to concentrate away from the source for water. And I'm just wondering if there could be a linkage between the veterinarians, the epi folks, and this goes back to the H1. The CDC spent over $5 million on planning our clinics when there were some of us who ran the clinics, well, prepared the clinics back in the 70s, and no one talked to us. And I just think history-wise, there's a mix between the different divisions. I'm just wondering what APHA or what's your... all of your take is on how we link history together. I mean, we can see it on the slides, but it's the deliverables that I'm concerned
with. Thanks,
for a rhetorical question.
I just go ahead. I'll ask my question after you.
If we see a connection in the emergence of new influenza strains with accelerated density or whatever numbers, 2 million to 10 million, we also therefore see additional changes in the influenza virus associated with those on a continual basis, not only in one state but in other places throughout the world. It seems like to me, how do we make that correlation? And if we do make that correlation, then how do we understand that that correlation should be made continually over the last 20 years with additional lots of other strains of influenza?
The data is very limited. In fact, really, to two regions. So we have some southern China. We've had decades of good slaughter plant research data coming in terms of swine infection. And then here in the States, we have a few decades. So we don't have the picture going back farther than maybe three decades now. But we do see that a remarkable stability. In fact, a stability that one does not see in the kingdom of influenza. So there were changes in human influenza, in fact, yearly practically. But for literally 80 years straight, we saw one strain in North America. It was the same strain, it didn't change. And then all these dramatic changes and continuing reassortments, and now we have quadruple assortments. And really just the last 20 years or so. And the question is, what caused that? A stable situation, and so the question is.
I understand that issue. Presented earlier, I'm asking an ongoing question of why don't we continue to see lots and lots of reassortments occurring in the face of, if that's the reason that caused the late 90s reassortment and the recent one, then if that's the cause, then why isn't it the cause of lots of different reassortments?
And we do, and there are more than a dozen now circulating swine flu viruses in North America. Where there was one before, there are now over a dozen. So we do see this.
Causally related.
I want to make sure that there's questions for their speakers. We have time for this, Jen.
Yeah, I had a question for Dr. Zambrowski. Based on what we know about other organisms that are present in milk, would you expect the effect of sample size and temperature to be different for other organisms? I know that you would need to validate it differently for different organisms. What would you expect based on what we know about other
with staph species, I'm going to expect the yield to go down. And actually, that kind of works to our advantage in terms of looking at overgrowth and whatnot. But obviously, we just want to make sure that we're not getting negative cultures and declaring an animal or an area disease-free that actually isn't disease-free. So I would expect, based on other organisms, looking at other organisms that commonly occur, usually associated with mastitis, that's what you're going to see. I would expect this to go down in terms of yield.
Conditions that were beneficial for culturing.
Would be my hypothesis.
Other questions for any? Go ahead, Jim.
I have a question for you. So I apologize, it's a bit inflammatory because the vast majority of veterinarians did not support Prop 2, including AVMA. And what my concern is that now farmers aren't going to be able to meet the financial demands. A lot of farmers are going to go out of business because they can't resize their farrowing crates in the same amount of time to have enough animals to be productive to meet their margin, and all of that business is going to go to Mexico.
So
now what's going to happen when, in an industry where we can control these things, where we have regulations, where we have biosecurity, California economy is going to go in the toilet, agricultural economy, and there's going to be mass exodus of production south of the border, and we're not going to be able to police that. So what do you think that's going to mean for us in terms of outbreaks and reassortment? And I think it's a little bit scary.
So the California Veterinary Medical Association in favor of Prop 2.
Yes.
The And that's what we heard during the campaign, particularly the egg producers, because it's a large egg producing state. That, you know, all the egg production is going to flood to Mexico, which even people in the industry said, no, they don't have the feed down there. It's just not going to happen, and it hasn't happened. And it's just, and egg production will just shift to Iowa, et cetera. Although now Schwarzenegger passed the law. Now by the phase-in date, all eggs sold in California have to be cage-free from birds not raised in cage. So that will presumably affect production in other arenas as well. According to the industry's own estimates, so Donald Bell, who's kind of the chief poultry economist, shifting from, for example, a batter cage facility to a cage-free facility, less than a penny an egg. I mean, the reason they're so expensive at the store, it's a niche market making booze. But in terms of production, it's less than a penny per egg, according to the industry, and people will pay. I mean, surveys, consumer surveys, so people will pay a penny an egg to, you know, have a bird spread their wings once in their life. And so these, I mean, these kind of, you know, the sky is falling kind of, you know, that you hear all the time, and it just hasn't happened.
And how do you think that that applies then to, so okay, a penny an egg and a bird can spread its wings, but if you look at natural chicken behaviors and you've got cage-free eggs, you also have much more cannibalism, you have birds pecking at each other, you have other negative impacts, and I'm not so sure people are willing to pay for that.
Depends.
And I don't think people know.
I mean, so these are, so you don't have cage layer fatigue, you don't have the osteoporosis, you know, I mean, in terms of an animal health, there's certainly a balance, and a lot of it depends, of course, on management. It's easier to manage cage facilities as opposed to cage-free facilities. But from a human health standpoint, as a physician, that's my bias. From a human health standpoint, you know, every one of the last 10 studies published in the last 5 years comparing salmonella rates, for example, which we're really concerned about next, between cage and cage-free facilities found lower rates in cage-free facilities. And so, from a public health standpoint, from a food safety standpoint, it would be smart, so not only animal welfare, to move towards a cage-free system.
See, I would argue against you that it's not smart in terms of animal welfare.
More questions. First, I take another question for another panel member, but then we'll take questions for Dr. Greger, too. So, any other questions for another panel member? We love you having you here, Kate.
Great introduction.
Go ahead. I think, who's up first? Melissa, or are you up first?
Well, unfortunately, the dialogue is very one-way. It is really hard to engage the human medical community on these kinds of things. The ASPCA did a very small program in New York where they actually had a community health center where they would do diabetes screening and all kinds of human preventive health things, and then they vaccinated animals and worked on spay neuter issues too. And it sounded really great, and I emailed the A, and they gave me as much information as they could, but I could not even reach by phone or email the human physicians involved. And, you know, that's a continual thing. Anytime you're working on this one health kind of thing,
right,
it tends to be a one-way. It's not an impossible nut to crack, it's just a much longer row to hoe, and we're really just sort of down here. And, you know, we're making inroads, and that's why I try to speak at as many human health conferences as I can, because it sensitizes them, and you never know when you're going to get that receptive person in the audience. You know, that was what got me into this whole thing, because when I worked in a shelter, and we would go into some of these hoarding cases, which you'll hear about tomorrow, I mean, it just was, bing, you know, this is a human issue. It's a huge public health issue, and yet the human medical profession was just oblivious, and they didn't want to hear about it, they didn't want to talk to you about it. And so it's been a 10-year odyssey banging that.
Successful doing it where neither entity is really in existence.
It's 10 o'clock, and my job is to say it's 10 o'clock and we're over. But I love to be able to have the discourse and the discussion that has comes to APHA because of the topics we present. But on the note of that question, you know, the curative medicine folks say the same thing about us public health and prevention people. And they go, oh, gee, do I really have to run these secondary prevention tests or not? And they will if they can make money. But we're going to have these ongoing challenges. So make sure you come tonight at 6 o'clock so we can discuss our business meeting about names and what the names mean. Also at 2:30 today for another session. And I want to thank every one of you for submitting papers and coming today and bringing about these exciting topics. And I hope to hear from you next year. Thanks a lot, everybody.